When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. We are wrapping up Season 5 of Electric Boogaloo. I include excerpts of my conversations with Aaron, Dr. Jan Doolittle-Wilson, and I include a short conversation with Curtis Runstetler. That conversation has to do with medieval concepts of alchemy, which I had no idea where to put because alchemy is really not a major theme in this book. It becomes a theme much later in the books. But alchemy did have analogs in the season I covered with Steve. A word on my conversation with Aaron. We discuss a little bit of the last duel. I ought to say mild spoilers, but for the most part, there's no spoilers because I hadn't seen the film yet. So this is before I did my Cocoons of Horror review with Steve Osborne. You can search for Cocoons of Horror wherever you search for podcasts. Without further ado, here is Bosmang Aaron.
I was also thinking, this is something you probably haven't seen because hardly anybody in America has seen this movie. The Last Duel.
I have not seen it yet, no.
It's interesting because Matt Damon and Adam Driver play characters that I referred to in our review of them as like a... You know how like if Hollywood makes an adaptation of a real life figure, they're almost always better looking, more glamorous, sure, more well-spoken, you know, yeah, like they've got that. Like, imagine if you took that telescope and looked at it through the backwards way. So you take so assume that Ned, the Sean Bean and Nikolai are the Hollywood versions and look backwards through the tube. And I swear to Christ, that's what Matt Damon and Adam Driver are, these French knights. Matt Damon is very much like Ned Stark. If you took like what other people say about Ned, you know, forget about what he says about himself. Everyone says that Ned is kind of like overly serious, can't take a joke,
right?
Stick in the mud, obsessed with honor to almost the point of absurdity and insecurity.
Yeah.
And that is exactly the portrait that Matt Damon, you know, this real life knight. And then, you know, Jaime Lannister, the kind of the playboy, the womanizer, like, although I guess that doesn't really, he only womanizes his sister, but doesn't take things seriously, but on a, you know, maybe more fun to be around. And also maybe has a little bit more metal than you think on first blush. Also like Jamie, a rapist. I just couldn't stop thinking about it. So if there's any,
you know,
Game
really
of Thrones
funny
fans out there, I would love to know what people's perspective. If you go out and see this movie, just think about in terms of like, this is Ned and Jamie, if real people.
That's interesting to me because I've seen Adam Driver play a lot of really sort of serious, you know, no-nonsense kind of men. And I've seen Matt Damon play a lot of shit-faced grin, wisecracking guys.
Sure.
So this seems to set them in reverse.
Yeah, there is a little bit of that.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it now because I want to see, I kind of have a man crush on Adam Driver. I feel like I need to see this version of him.
He's dreamy. He's real. He's kind of a monster in this film. But like, yeah, just watch how many times like Matt Damon, look how many times he like gets tripped over honor, like completely makes an ass of himself, destroys political alliances in him just because of what his not even like a universal concept of honor, but like the way he sees it, you know. And I just thought that was I kept on thinking that because like Ned Like, again, gets up, Lannisters are preparing for war. Oh, those silly, deluded Lannisters. Don't they know that I'm the hero and I'm going to win? A message comes. Renly has split. He has hit the hills. Huh, that's odd. I was kind of counting on his swords, but, you know, oh, well, everything's going to be fine when Stannis shows up. And like, every single time he, you know, he can't even get to this thing without leaning on Littlefinger. It's just, he's so, and like how he thinks he's so shrewd too. There's a scene where he's trying to like keep the whole truth of the regency and stuff from the small council. And he's like, oh, this need for deceit's leaving such a bitter taste in my mouth. But boy, it's a small price to be playing the game this well and at this level. I'm like, oh, Ned. Oh, no. Oh, no.
I'm glad you brought up Jamie. I was kind of wondering this reread. I was thinking, isn't it weird that Jamie isn't in the throne room? Like, I know that he's fled the city and for good reason.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to actually have
he's recalled by his father, right?
I think so. But here we have in the throne room an altercation, and Cersei and Joffrey and Myrcella are all there. Doesn't it seem more like Jaime's character to like come back and stand by their side, you know, his own danger be damned, you know, his own safety be damned? It seems a little bit like a lot to leave absent.
Yeah, and I don't know whether Martin will turn the corner with Jaime or not, but like in the books, he's a completely disinterested father. Like they added that the dimension to him in the series. So I don't think he gives a shit about Myrcella or Joffrey
but Cersei the one thing in the world he cares about is
he would Cersei, definitely right? wage war, the you know, war for Cersei's birth canal for sure. But I do wonder, like, is that the correct sequence of events? Because like I thought maybe that his dad had recalled him getting together an invasion, impending invasion.
Yeah.
Once Robert was fallen sick, because that's clearly the Lannister's plan. And then, you know, he just kind of got caught out. Did they describe him as fleeing the city?
Yeah. He had fled the city right after his altercation with Ned in the street.
Oh, I guess right.
The other thing about this that I probably should keep in mind is that, you know, maybe Tywin's shadow is over this whole thing. And so if Tywin's shadow is over the whole thing, then Tywin is already gathering for war.
Right.
And so, of course, he wants Jaime with him. If it was up to Jaime, I think Jaime would be in the room. Also, you know, it could just be like, hey, man, it takes 2 days to get from one place to the next. You know, you don't have like season 8 jetpacks yet in the show.
Because it did seem like Cersei was like, again, if you take her at her word at this later conversation where she's reflecting about Ned almost beat her if it hadn't been for Sansa, like it seemed like maybe the Lannisters might have underestimated Ned a bit too, that they would have thought, you know, like he wouldn't have taken these steps to prepare for treachery before, like he would have just been like, okay, well, you know, I got to wait till Robert's dead to do anything. And, you know, maybe they may have misunderstimated him as well.
And now a short excerpt of my longer conversation with Jan Doolittle Wilson.
But if you think about the other two alternatives, right? It was basically Ned, Robert, or John Arryn. Do you think John Arryn would have been a good king? More than Ned?
Yeah, probably better than either those other two.
We just don't know a lot about him, though, right?
The more I learn about him, the more I think he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer.
he certainly underestimated the Lannisters.
Robert beggars the realm. He puts the realm in debt to Tywin. And somehow, I mean, you can't do that without Robert Arryn sort of knowing that it's happening. And whether or not he's like protesting or whatever, he's the hand of the king. He's supposed to rein Robert in. That's not supposed to happen.
Yeah.
He's the one that tells Robert to marry Cersei. That was a horrible decision. And then, of course,
and to give Tywin that much access and power to the kingdom. And then Jaime's in the Kingsguard. I mean, it's just, wow.
Yeah. He doesn't do right by Lysa, at least from her point of view. He doesn't do right by her. So I don't know. Maybe there's not a great, you know, this is the problem with power. It's like if your system of power only works if a saint with a certain amount of power and a certain amount of nobility and a certain narrative to the throne, the perfect alchemy to make, you know, this leader. If your system of government only works if that can happen, there's just going to be so many flawed men who take advantage of that.
And that's kind of one of the biggest themes of the series, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's this idea of what form of government is best. Is it the system of might is right? Are we going for a new system? Where does Daenerys fit into this? Mm-hmm. It's all set up here from the very beginning. And you're right. Once Robert dies, game on. I mean, game had already started, but once Robert dies, right, that vacuum, and then suddenly the plays for power and the forces are, you've got how many different sigils from the Baratheon house now, right? You've got within even the same house, you've got these plays for power. And,
what's interesting to me is that immediately previous, Viserys dies.
Yes, the golden crown.
Uh-huh. Right. So you've got the usurper Robert and, you know, the last dragon, and this whole thing is set up like, you know, these are the two guys who have the best claim to the throne. And within a space of, 10 pages, they're both dead.
They're both dead. That's a good point. Yep, they're both gone.
It's not like Viserys is much of a vacuum either. He was also kind of a zero. But now,
believe that Robert is the usurper,
right,
he is the next in
That's
line.
Right. That's right. And all
Regardless
of a sudden,
of what you think about him, and he's awful, but
all
still.
Of these political minds are thinking, well, now's my chance.
Mm-hmm.
And it all, you know, so they all kind of converge. You know, Robert's a giant nothing in his life. And in the end, he becomes the biggest vacuum that you could imagine.
Yeah.
So.
And it depends on what you think of as legitimacy in this world, right? So we just talked about the idea that sometimes legitimacy to the throne is just who is the biggest guy, who is the strongest warrior. Right. But there's also so much stock in this world put into blood.
Well, right, and that's why Robert gets it in anyway, right?
Yeah.
Robert has some sort of link to the Targaryens like way, way back in the day.
That's
so
right.
So they think that he's sort of the most palatable. It's such a significant turn in the story.
Transition.
Yeah.
Huge transition. Nothing's the same after this.
Uh-huh. I also think that there might be a tiny little hint at Lord of the Rings here. Littlefinger says, he's got this great line that he says, "The power is yours. Mm. All you need to do is reach out and grab it."
Yeah.
In Tolkien's world, if you can resist that, then you've won. You know, whether you live or die, you've won because you've passed the test.
Yeah.
You didn't grasp for the Ring of Power. So the hero of the story is the person who can resist the Ring of Power, right?
Right.
In this world, it's a little different. It could be that Ned can't take Renly's offer. He can't take Littlefinger's advice because it looks so nakedly gross to him.
Yeah.
It's like reaching out for the one ring and becoming a Dark Lord. It's just Ned, that's not who Ned is, right?
It's not.
And yet reaching out for power is probably the best thing Ned could have done at this point.
Yes.
So it's this weird thing where this isn't Tolkien's word. You're not going to be rewarded for not reaching out for the power. In fact, you might die because you couldn't do it.
And if I can throw in another analogy, again, Harry Potter's on the brain.
Yeah.
I keep thinking about this line from Harry Potter. Apologies to the listeners who aren't Harry Potter people, but one of the major themes of that series is power, right? And Dumbledore says to Harry so many times, those who want power the most are least suited to it. And I kept thinking about that as I read this chapter. And in terms of, you know, Ned doesn't want the power. He doesn't want that role at all.
Yeah.
But yet, would he be suited to sit the throne? No. He would be a terrible ruler and prove to be a terrible ruler in many ways, much like Robert, right?
Well, we've seen it already, right? He was in the throne room and, you know, he decides, okay, we're going to have to track down the mountain and bring him to justice. And he really, you know, Varys is saying, you know what? There's a way to do this. And you seem to be doing it the wrong way. But, you know, it's probably, you know, we'll see what happens. But you know it because Varys is saying it. You know it was a bad decision.
Yes, yes.
So yeah, he's not a great ruler for sure.
Not a great ruler. You know, I wrote this in my notes. Robert, great warrior, terrible king.
Yeah.
Ned, great person, terrible politician. You know, yeah. The two don't always go hand in hand. Just because you're a good person does not mean you should be in this highest echelon of power. Mm. Even if you don't intend to use the power to benefit yourself, it's still not, you know, a position you should be in because you don't make decisions. You don't make the hard decisions. You're not able to make the hard decisions that do dip into deceit and lies and treachery for the greater good, right? For this idea of, well, I have to play the game on this level to benefit this kind of greater concept. Mm. Ned's just not, he's going to do what he thinks is right in the most immediate context. And again, he's not thinking on that level of, okay, 10 chess moves down the road, what will this doing the right thing now, would it create even greater harm later? That's just not how he thinks at all.
Yeah.
And even Varys, who, you know, I think Varys is right when he says to Ned, I'm thinking about the kingdom. You know, even Varys says, well, yeah, we should go kill Daenerys. I hate it. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. But, you know, in the long run, this is what we should do. You know, Varys is able to think on that level. Ned just, no, you're killing a child. You're killing a child's child. No.
Yeah.
No.
Jan, as always, it's lovely to talk with you. And
so much fun.
I learned so much in our conversations.
Thanks, Anthony. Always a pleasure.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
I I include a short excerpt of my longer conversation with Dr. Curtis Runstedler. Curtis teaches in Germany, but he got his dissertation where I did, University of Durham in England. And he wrote his dissertation about alchemy, but relative to poetic representations of alchemy. This is probably the nerdiest conversation you'll ever listen to. What was your dissertation topic at Durham? I'm curious.
So I looked at alchemy in Middle English poetry in the 14th and 15th century. And I was looking at how these poems containing alchemy or alchemical poems could be read as exemplary narratives. So how they were used to kind of make moral points about alchemical practice and the validation of the practice. So I started off with more well-known tales. So I looked at Chaucer's Canon's Yeoman's Tale and the Canterbury Tales, and then an alchemical exegesis in John Gower's Confessio Mantis. That was a 14th century poem as well. He was a friend of Chaucer. And then I started looking at more kind of obscure stuff. So I looked at an alchemical version of John Lydgate's The Churl and the Bird, which was written in the 15th century. And I looked at some other manuscripts. There was a manuscript at Cambridge, and it was between Merlin and Morienus. And it was more kind of Christian allegory for alchemical practice. So the father and son. So obviously very religious poem. And I also looked at another alchemical dialogue between Albertus Magnus, who was a alchemist in the he was actually Thomas Aquinas's teacher as well too. And he has a dialogue with the Queen of Elves. They talk about alchemy too, but it's also you can have an allegorical reading of it as well too. So I looked at how all these poems are kind of exemplary in nature and the kind of implications for that. So it was a lot of fun to write about. Mm.
Now, 15th century. So, I mean, was there ever a time that alchemy was sort of viewed as mainstream, or was it always kind of looked on with suspicion?
Well, actually, you know, it was always kind of looked on with suspicion. But even, you know, they had these kind of prohibitions against, I think, one of the popes, Pope John the 22nd, had a prohibition against alchemy, but he wasn't a very popular pope. So I think people still practice it anyway. I think Henry the Sixth also had kind of prohibitions against alchemy, but you know, they had a lot of these alchemists or a lot of these kind of physicians trying to link mm-hmm. it to medicine too, and trying to kind of get petitions to practice alchemy. Obviously, they were never successful with it, but sometimes they come up with cool stuff along the way, or you wouldn't hear about their experiments at all. So it was always kind of controversial. It was always kind of being banned, but at the same time, I think there was always this dual side to it. You know, one hand too, it could kind of eliminate poverty. You know, there was a lot of medicinal benefits to it theoretically, but on the other hand, it was so dangerous too, it was very expensive, and you know, nobody really knew if it worked or not. So
I mean, famously, sort of the lead into gold kind of thing was mm-hmm. sort of like this, I don't know, the epitome of what alchemy could do, right? Or the most Absolutely. Aspirational thing that alchemy could do. But of course, alchemy yeah. was, I mean, the practice itself had a wider spectrum.
Absolutely. So that was the main goal, was the transmutation of base metals, so lead or tin, into gold or silver. But there's also another goal too, which was the elixir vitae, so elixir of life too. So an elixir that was meant to kind of prolong your life. In Western alchemy, we see more of the kind of first goal. But as we go into the Renaissance, too, we have Paracelsus, the batshit crazy Swiss alchemist that has more medicinal aspects. And then we have the kind of homunculus too. But yeah, speaking of like medieval alchemy, it's mostly those two goals, I would say. Yeah.
Right. And of course, we see this sort of as the inspiration for the Harry Potter series, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they actually have Nicholas Flamel too. So Nicholas Flamel was, I think he's this kind of pseudonymous figure too, but in the 17th century, they had this resurgence of kind of alchemical texts too in the 18th century. And I think they attributed to Nicholas Flamel. So he wrote this treatise on the Philosopher's Stone, which we know is probably pseudonymous, but that's a lot of case too. They'll have these kind of famous historical figures attributed to this text, you know, Thomas Aquinas or Albertus Magnus. But I mean, they didn't actually write these alchemical texts, but yeah, that's where we get Nicholas Flamel from, who we have in Harry Potter. And even though yeah. they don't show him, and it's interesting too, because it kind of, because in the Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, I mean, you needed a moral practitioner too. They had to kind of have this kind of ordinal of alchemy, whereas we see, you know, Quirrell and Voldemort, as hard as they try, they can't get it because they're just greedy and unscrupulous. That's why they can't see it in the Mirror of Erised, whereas Harry Potter is actually able to get the Philosopher's Stone. And I think what's interesting about Harry Potter too is that, you know, alchemy actually works in that world. You know, he's actually able to hold the Philosopher's Stone in his hand, and it's symbolic of the final alchemical stage too. So there's four alchemical stages, and the rubedo stage is the reddening stage, and we see actually the red Philosopher's Stone. So Nicholas Flamel was successful after all.
My thanks again to Curtis and Jan and Aaron. And now Steve and I wrap up season 5 with a little bit of retrospective and some meta conversation.
Okay, so we're wrapping up season 5 now. And at this point, you may be interested to know, all of these plot lines are now moving beyond the book material.
Okay.
And we ended up getting our first confirmed book spoiler. So in the books, Shireen does not become a human sacrifice. She's left at the wall.
Okay.
But once this happened and everyone freaked out, George Martin was asked, hey, what the heck? And he says, that's going to happen in the books. So he confirmed that this is going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet in the books. Basically, all of these storylines for all of our favorite characters are now going to be moving beyond all of the book content.
Well, but Martin's still a part of all this process to some level, nope. Right? I mean, he's like a consultant.
He was a producer. This year, if I remember correctly, he had a little falling out with the other producers of the show, with the showrunners. So the showrunner, there was a lot of worry that, okay, Martin's not really in the fold anymore. Season 5 wasn't up to our expectations. And on top of that, you know, we don't like what happened with Sansa, not in the books, with Shireen, not in the books, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that there was this general concern that the show was going downhill.
Mm-hmm.
Can these showrunners live up to what they were able to produce with the book content to follow? And I think, I don't think it's going to be a surprise to you to learn that actually they did pretty well with season 6.
That's what I've heard.
People
I've heard
were
season
pretty
six
happy
is,
with season 6.
In the sense that season 5 is consensus, like, if not the worst season, it's like a bottom 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Six oftentimes it seems like people have maybe up as number 1.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would put like season 1, 4, and 6 pretty high. And right. it generally probably gets top 2 billing.
Well, so that's kind of exciting. And here's the thing, and this is actually, and maybe time will tell, but I'm like, if 5 is considered pretty lowly regarded, and I liked it. I mean, there's some really great things that happen in this season, and where the narrative goes, I'm really satisfied with. I'm very satisfied with where we are at the moment. It gives me a little bit of hope for the overall how I'm going to view this series in its entirety.
Well, I'll encourage a little hope, but I will not encourage a lot of hope. But I will say that I think you'll enjoy season 6 for sure.
Okay. Yeah, there's one other thing. I think it had to do with like the book concept. So with the Shireen thing, like, so even if Martin's not a consultant, there was plenty of conversation prior and during, so I'm sure that the showrunners have a pretty good handle on a lot of things. So even if they're not getting real-time consultation, they have a lot of ideas already that Martin may have shared with what's going to happen.
I think that the word on the street has always been that he gave Benioff and Weiss a general outline, because they were like, look, we love your books, they're not done, but we kind of need to build to an ending here. We need to foreshadow and all this business. So we're going to need a general outline of how this thing is going to wrap up. And he said, well, I'm going to have the books done, so don't worry about that. But here's a general outline. And so he created a general outline for them based on his notion of where the books will go, at least what his notion was 10 years ago or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and then once the series wrapped up, he did confirm. He's like, yeah, a lot of it basically follows the outline. And then some of it doesn't. So, you know.
And he also reserves the right to change it because he's just got a focus group.
Yeah, that's right.
if
he
that
just
matters.
Got the world's biggest focus group. Now, this has been my suggestion that I've had for years. So let's say you're Martin and like you get some bad diagnosis and you're like, I'm not going to be around for long enough to finish these books. I would go out and I would tap 5 different authors that I really respect, like Stephen King and company, and say, all of you write your own version of this. And so then instead of like reading the final ending, I get to read like five different versions of Game of Thrones.
And it's sort of becomes more like it starts to mimic the idea of lore.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Instead of the four gospels, it's the five gospels. And it's like, well, actually, I like the way King does this better than I like the way Silva does that.
That'd be great. So now are you rooting for death?
Not rooting for death. I'd love for George to live forever. I love him. And at the same time, I'm a little angry.
All right.
All right, so let's go back to the War of the Five Kings predictions again, right?
Yeah, man, I was thinking about that this morning.
So I don't think Stannis is going to win.
Yeah, Stannis' odds have decreased dramatically. Robb's have not improved since last we saw him. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Right, Joffrey is still purple face as far as we know.
As far as we know, he's grotesque.
He is still choking, actually. I mean,
he's still just bleeding out the nose on the floor of the wedding.
It's a really slow Dornish poison.
Even like the High Sparrows had to step over him a few times. I was like, yeah, this is the one time I wish I had shoes.
Yeah, so I would imagine that we're going to return to Lord Greyjoy.
Yeah, I figured, season. Well, I guess he's got the advantage by being alive still.
He's got the advantage by being alive, and Theon has now, I don't know, like left Reek behind?
So his
plot is still, I mean, it's still a live possibility, in other words.
It's a possibility, but this guy, even if Reek returns to Theon, I still think he's more Reek than Theon at this point in time, right? I mean, because there's actually less Theon than there used to be.
There is a lot less Theon. So, all right, so back to these five kings. Your stance was always probably Joffrey because of Tyrion, right?
Right.
We can basically transfer that onto Dany now, right?
Right. And the Joffrey is now just, you could just say the house of whatever's left of Lannister.
That's right. That's right. So you've got, what are Dany's assets? Well, she's kind of lost the city.
Right.
She's got a big dragon she's riding around.
And she's got three dragons, one that she's riding around, one that seems wounded.
She's still got a couple pretty decent armies, and she's got both Tyrion and the armies
have been pretty damaged, right? I mean, I don't know how many did they lost in the Sons of the Harpy.
I think it's a little crazy, but you think, how come there weren't like just 20 score unsullied.
Yeah.
Around her in that pit? That to me, that's like, geez. So I didn't think a lot of Unsullied died during that event because
there wasn't very many Unsullied there.
Yeah. So why, number one, why not have more there? Number two, well, anyway, so her assets are, she's got armies, she's got at least one dragon that she can kind of control, and she's got Varys and Tyrion, right?
Right.
So I think that she's got to be the odds-on favorite, too.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it does feel like, I mean, I don't know what Greyjoy could provide, right? So now we got to put in the House of Bolton, right?
Well, let me just give you a little, like, in the books, this hasn't happened yet, but you get the sense that Dany can't control the dragons. And this is a big problem. And in addition to that, is she's got these armies, but she doesn't have a massive amount of ships yet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what happens in the books that unfortunately doesn't happen in the show is that there's this side plot with this Greyjoy that we haven't met yet. And he finds this magic horn that's supposed to be able to bend the will of dragons. He's got this magic horn. He's going to go and he's going to propose to Dany, bring the ships, bring his magic horn with him. And there, maybe you'll see a little alliance between the Greyjoys and Dany.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, the show doesn't really do that with the magic horn and all that business. But
Okay. Anyway,
you haven't seen the last of the Greyjoys, just so you know. But Dany's got, I guess all that is to say is that Dany's got, I think, more assets than other contenders at this point.
Sure. And
with Cersei does have Frankenstein's monster, right, slash
with
Darth
other
Vader.
Contenders starting to like kind of disappear.
Right.
Well, I mean, again, this all assumes that Dany gets out of whatever horde situation she's in. Are we to assume these are Dothrakis?
I think so. Yeah. These are, okay. these are Dothrakis.
The sword seems similar. So I'm like, so my initial thought is like, oh, good. More Dany with Dothraki.
Yeah, the Dothraki.
It feels a little bit like, well, we've strayed from the books. What worked before? Dany and the Dothrakis. Well, we'll do that again.
Right. I think that maybe you're giving this a little bit of short shrift here, because,
well, I'm very patient.
A lot of
funny narratives, and I feel like it every time it's like, patience, 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 dragons. Patience, 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 dragons.
Right.
No, so no, I'm that's like, right. I'm like, all right, you know, you did it. You did it to me again. You got me with this. And I'm like, oh, let me see if I can. Let's see.
Well, let me just remind you.
I just get my calculator out. Ooh, episode 9 or 10, dragons.
I will take the point of a privilege here to remind you so much of Dany's character was parlayed off of Dothraki culture. Mm-hmm. A lot of she got introduced as, so much so that for the first 3 seasons, most fans just called her Khaleesi, right?
Sure.
Khaleesi just means queen in Dothraki.
Yeah, I think I've referred to her.
Yeah.
Because I think Jorah kept on Khaleesi.
That's right. And so that's so much part of her identity that it almost feels like if they don't bring
a return back. Yeah. Almost a don't forget where you came from. Like this might be a reboot for her to some degree
because
she's in a bit of a bind, and there was definitely some advantages she gained from that. Yeah, I get it. I guess I just
and when we first met,
if I gotta see her walk through the desert one more time, dude.
If when we first met her, she was being sold as sort of this slave, you know, child bride or whatever, but she was basically a slave to the Dothraki. And look at all she's gained in these last 5 seasons, and yet at the end of season 5, guess what? She's a slave to the Dothraki.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. I'm interested. I'd like to see what
I'm happens. Cautiously optimistic, but like I said, if there is a 9-episode march through the desert to get back to Marine only to find a dragon again or whatever, I'm like this to me is a bigger deal than the Red Wedding.
All right. So Tyrion sort of advising Dany. And now Davos is up at the wall.
Yeah.
Stannis is gone, but Mel is at the wall now.
That's interesting, right? So you have Davos and Mel at the wall.
And you got to imagine there's going to be some kind of reckoning for Mel, right?
You have to assume so. But also, I don't know what's Mel? What's her sitch? Right? I mean, so she's like, she's look, man, she can birth smoke, baby. She's clearly dealing with the supernatural, right? So
yeah, but does she know as much as she thinks she knows? Because my feeling is, okay, what did you really see in the fire? You might have seen a battle in the snow. Well, check. We saw that.
Right.
You thought you saw yourself on the battlements of Winterfell. Well, okay, but clearly Stannis isn't going to be with you. If that's going to happen, and you know that there's a big battle with the White Walkers, probably. All right. So that's probably still going to happen, but you're kind of connecting these dots in a way that makes sense to you. But should you have this much certainty about the way you're connecting the dots?
Well, but that is, I think, a fascinating critique on religion, right? Exactly. It doesn't throw out the possibility of the supernatural, but what it does is it says the supernatural can be complicated by human interpretation.
Or, I mean, let's just imagine that, I mean, this is Martin's created a world where like the seasons can last, you know, 50 years or whatever, like winter can last 50 years. So the laws of nature are a little bit different in this world. So it could be that she's tapped into some kind of law of nature, some sort of cosmic force or something. And she's basically interpreted it with religious eyes.
Right.
But in reality, you know, she's kind of playing with some sort of power she doesn't quite understand.
Right. And so that's one thing that's interesting to me is like, is she returning deflated? Is she returning like, okay, I gotta regroup and reinterpret or what? Or, I mean, she looked pretty just like, well, I guess not. You know, it just, and so you have Davos who's, I mean, now Davos doesn't really understand exactly everything that went down, right? I mean, that's, I mean, he just knows, I think he got the gist that they didn't make it, right?
Well, that's a good
question. Or at least Shireen, question. Right? Like, he knows Shireen didn't make it, or does he?
I don't know what he knows and what he doesn't know, because he was sort of trying to get John, he was basically, earlier in the episode, he's trying to get John to, like, you know, bring the Wildling army down and help me fight, right?
Right, because he's still going. But then when Mel comes back, is there any...
We don't see that encounter yet. So that's the encounter that we're waiting for, right?
Okay, so because I didn't know if he saw her come back and was like, well, shit, it's over.
Yeah, I don't remember very well how that went.
I might be putting too much into Davos's interpretation of that. But like, I don't know, if I'm him... And basically, everything with Stannis has been a choice between him and Melisandre.
Yeah.
To see Melisandre alone seems pretty ominous, right? Like,
it can't be good,
right? I mean, you were the one. you're the magic. Why is magic here? So, I mean, yeah. Who knows? I mean, I'm not exactly sure where he's at with that, but I don't think he feels good. So Davos is there. She's there. There's no Stannis army, and that's it. I mean, that's what you got. And you now you have obvious. There's got to be some division on the wall, right? I mean, I have to think that Jon Snow. I mean, we know Jon Snow has friends. He may have less friends than he has enemies in the wall, but like so they're both. I mean, what a weird collection at this point. You have a split in the wall that regardless of how you view Thorne and the Wildlings, they killed the Lord Commander.
They killed the Lord Commander. That's not going to make them very popular with a lot of the Night's Watch. However, there's like 50 left, and I don't know how many Wildlings came, but it had to be like hundreds, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And what are they going to do? I mean... It's not like they have any power anymore, right? The Wildlings are just going to run roughshod of them.
That's true. That complicates things on so many levels. And then you add on top of it, okay, well, now you've got Davos and Mel, and you're like, well, are they going to join forces somehow? Like, is this going to be the new buddy pairing, the unlikely duo, or is she...
Buddies between who?
Davos and Melisandre.
Yeah, yeah, they're the unlikely pair that are thrown together, and you know, antics ensue. Now, I will, as we wrap up, I'm gonna throw a hot take at you, Steve, that I've never uttered before.
Oh boy!
But I just want you to consider this possibility. Dany's, you know, big black dragon is named Drogon.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Drogon sucks.
Oh.
Maybe he just sucks. I mean, he flies into the pit. He burns people alive, but then he kind of gets distracted, and then he gets a bunch of spears in him.
Spears, yeah.
Flies away, takes Dany out in the middle of nowhere, and then just kind of like...
Pouts?
Pouts, broods a little bit... Goes to sleep, doesn't get Dany any food. She's trying to get him to do what she wants him to do, and he's just like, nah, I think I'm just going to hang out here. And we kind of learn that he sucks.
Well, does he? Here's the thing. He's a dragon.
Yeah, he's
dragon's
a dragon.
Dragon's going to dragon, dude. Dragons are going to dragon. So you've got a dragon. What?
When you say that about someone... It normally means that in some way that they suck.
Well, the thing is they may suck, but they may suck by nature. So to judge it, it's like saying that cat is a terrible driver.
Like Toonsis the driving cat?
Like that's the whole lesson. Like that was the whole lesson with Toonsis, right? I mean, sure, you were amazed that the cat could drive, but you should never be surprised that it was going to crash.
Yeah, but he was doing so well for a little while there.
Well, that's the thing. Drogon is like, yeah, you need people burned alive? Get a dragon. You want something to yell at you? Get a dragon. Want to see something fly really rad? Get a dragon. You want something to obey your every command and get you food? Get a butler.
Well, okay, so Drogon sucks as a butler.
Terrible butler. Pretty solid dragon.
So I'd like to see a Mr. Belvedere reboot with Drogon.
Oh, see, that'd be great. Everyone's looking to him for like some sort of sage advice and he just sets them on fire.
It's a new family every episode.
Every episode, it's the same thing. You're just like, oh no, little Billy is experimenting with marijuana.
It'll be a few weeks before Steve and I get together to watch season 6, but if you miss us, you can tune into our new podcast, Perfect Stranger Things.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'll say a few things about chivalry, which has been a Season 5 theme. About 3 months back, I got a nice email from a fellow named Donnie. Donnie writes, "Something I've been curious about and hoped you could expand on is how one became a knight in olden times. As far as Game of Thrones perspective, it seems like most knights need some combination of knighthood, like a prestigious house, training, squiring, a connection, you know other knights or lords, etc.
I was hoping that you and your esteemed colleagues could compare and contrast the steps toward knighthood in both Our World and A Song of Ice and Fire. Thanks. Donnie, I hope that this season has been useful to you. I'll just recap some of the things that I learned this season, and maybe you learned along with me. We learned from Elio Garcia that in Martin's world, a knight or king must perform the knighthood ceremony. This may or may not involve a septon and the religious ceremony of being anointed, etc., etc. Elio pointed out to us that in the So Spake Martin archive, Gurm has confirmed that the greater the person performing the ceremony, the more prestigious the knighthood. So, for example, Barristan Selmy, having been knighted by a king, will rise higher and faster than someone like Duncan the Tall, who was knighted by some guy no one's ever heard of. We learned from Carol Parrish Jameson that this parallels medieval history pretty well. Prestige of one's family, social location, wealth, etc., were all factors in dubbing. The concept of knighthood was married to specific knightly codes. And while these were modeled in part after monastic codes, the office was secular at the start. Later they took on religious significance, and this was fortified further during the Crusades. Also in common, both Martin's world and medieval Europe had ideals of knighthood, and then varying levels of lesser knights depending on circumstance. Jameson also pointed out that the ideals of knightly codes were aspirational from the start. As such, it is difficult for knights to live up to these codes in the real world. Two key reasons are, number one, knights were flawed men, and two, the codes sometimes harbored internal contradictions. There are, however, a few differences between the Knights of Ice and Fire and the real knights of history. First, in Jameson's email to me, she writes, medieval chivalric manuals make very clear that only certain individuals are fit for knighthood. So I don't know that Davos, the Onion Knight, would have been so easily dubbed in reality. End quote. She notes that sometimes lower class folks could buy their way into the upper classes. But this isn't quite what happens with Davos. Another difference between real and fantastic worlds, Martin seems to have pushed together several different iterations of knighthood from varying regions and different eras. Lastly, in real-life trial by combat, the champions were supposed to be equals. I mentioned this in my coverage of the last duel with Steve. But to clarify, a duel between someone like Bronn, the free rider, and Sir Vardis Egan wouldn't have been allowed by the ideals of chivalry. Also, for the same reason, the battle between Beric and Sandor wouldn't have been seen as equitable. So, thank you for your email, Donnie, and just to reiterate, book@baldmove.com, without a doubt, your emails improve the content of this podcast. This is all stuff I didn't know before this season started. So do please keep the questions and feedback coming. I'll be taking a couple weeks off between seasons here. If you're looking to get caught up, we will start again with chapter 50 next we record. And that is all for this week.